Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Hello, I'm Assumpta Latus, and these are our main stories here at Africa Link. Mali welcomes UN approval for an African-led military force, while many ordinary Malians wonder why is it taking so long to liberate the north.
It is clearly unfortunate, especially for the population which is trapped in the north, to wait for several months before any action could take place. But it is also important to take into consideration the complexity of the crisis and the risk that would be associated to a military operation if it's not well prepared.
Tribal clashes in Kenya's Tana Delta region kill more than 30 people.
At dawn, they woke up, that is the Oromo, only to find the Pokomo swarming into their villages, attacking them. No reason was given at that time by the local chief.
Stay with us for those stories and more coming up in the next 25 minutes.
Top story.
Mali's government on Friday held UN Security Council approval for an African-led military force to reconquer the north from Islamist militants. The UN Security Council approved the creation of an African military force for a period of 1 year and authorized the force to take all the necessary measures to assist the government of Mali in efforts aimed at recovering the areas in the north of its territory under the control of armed groups. This report by Peter Hille is now presented by Susan Holton.
For Mali's Foreign Minister, Timan Koulibaly, the Security Council resolution marks a historic step in the fight against terrorism.
Mali welcomes this resolution. It shows the engagement of the international community on the side of Mali in the fight against terrorism and organized cross-border crime. They threaten regional stability and peace and security in the world.
Back in October, the UN Security Council made clear it would support an intervention mission to Mali. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, said it could have a force of more than 3,000 soldiers ready to march into Mali and support Malian troops in the fight against the rebels. But the UN's most powerful organ considered this plan to be insufficient. After months of deliberation and improvements to the original ECOWAS plan, the Security Council has now, for the first time, given the green light for an African-led mission. It will be known as AFISMA, meaning African-led International Support Mission. The Security Council has yet to stipulate a timeline for the intervention. What is also lacking is money. A military mission could cost up to 500 million euros. UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon is to hold talks with donor countries to raise the necessary funding. Former German ambassador to Mali, Karl Flittner, says this could be very challenging.
Apart from the European Union, no one has come forward to support the mission financially. The Malian army is unfortunately very weak, demoralized and poorly equipped. And they cannot take back the north from the jihadists on their own. They need support. And I do think the EU is the right organization to help. So far, there are no other donors, but one should start looking for them.
If the mission does not fail because of financial constraints, how easy will it be for ECOWAS to put boots on the ground? EU member states and the United States have said they will not send their armies to fight in Mali. Any intervention would probably not take place before the autumn of next year. However, Germany and other EU nations have said they will support the mission when it begins, not only with money but also with military advisers. As the former colonial power, France still has close ties with Mali, politically and economically. Most recently, it was the only country that strongly supported a military solution to Mali's crisis. Paris was the driving force behind the draft resolution. Gérard Araud is the French ambassador to the United Nations.
Notre texte n'est pas une déclaration de guerre.
Our text is not a declaration of war. With our text, we are not choosing a military option. On the contrary, we are expressing our hope for a dialogue between the government in Bamako and the insurgents and terrorists in the north that will lead to a political solution to allow elections throughout the country.
Indeed, the UN Security Council is calling on Bamako to continue the peace talks that have already started. Since early December, Mali's interim government has been negotiating with two of the four rebel groups that control the north. One group is Ansar Dine, the Defenders of the Faith, and the other is made up of Tuareg rebels from the Movement for the Liberation of Azawad, MNLA. However, both have been largely driven out of larger towns in the north by more radical Islamist groups.
Susan Holton with that report by Peter Healy. West African nations say that more than 3,000 troops are ready to go to Mali to help rebuild the country's army and support a military operation, which planners say cannot be launched before September of next year. I have been talking to Gilles Yabi, an expert on Mali at the International Crisis Group in Senegal, to find out why is it taking so long to get the north liberated.
It is clearly unfortunate, especially for the population which is trapped in the north, to wait for several months, maybe a year, before any action could take place. But it is also important to take into consideration the complexity of the crisis and the risk that would be associated to a military operation if it's not well prepared. It would have been simpler if the crisis was just about the capture of the north by rebels and by Islamist groups, but you would remember that there was also a military coup in March, and that means that the entire state has been destabilized and the army has been destabilized as well. So in these conditions, it is important to make sure that the political situation is stabilized in Bamako, in the capital. You have to be sure that the military is under control of political authorities. So you have to stabilize the transition itself before engaging into a military operation, which will go with a number of risks.
The resolution puts the intervention in two phases, political and military. How will these phases be implemented?
The resolution which has been voted is basically giving the general framework of the several months in terms of what needs to be done and what kind of international support the Malian authorities can expect. I think an important thing to see is that there are two general component. One is the political process, and it is important to see in the resolution that this first chapter of this resolution is about the political process. So there is really the international community calling for Malian authorities to give priority to a political process involving negotiations with some of the armed groups in the north, the ones which are not associated to terrorist groups. And then you have the second chapter, which is about basically the security and the military process, the training and restructuring of the Malian defense and security forces. And then you have the authorization of a military mission led by African countries.
Well, looking at the time frame, when is the military force going to be deployed? Should we assume that the UN favors a political solution rather than a military one?
I don't think so. It is true that there are various positions within the international community and that there are a lot of reservations from a number of interlocutors. But at the same time, I think that there is now a wide agreement between ECOWAS, the regional organization in West Africa, the African Union, and the UN Security Council, on the fact that there is a need for a two-track approach involving political process and military action. The impact of a military action can start with just the threat. Giving credibility to the threat of military action is important. That's why the training and restructuring of the Malian army is important, and that's why also the authorization of the deployment of an African mission is important as a signal that the international community is behind Mali and will not let the situation, you know, last forever. But again, at the same time, the reality is that you have many rebel groups in the north. You have some of the groups which have kind of a political agenda, and they can be included in a negotiated process. What is important is to make sure that in this process, the various community living in the north will also be associated. So this political track is important also in the perspective of a military action. What is important is to isolate the terrorist groups, the ones really that could not be integrated in any political process. And to reach that level, you need, again, some political work being done quickly in Bamako. It is important now that we have a new prime minister in Mali who is more capable than the previous one and who should be able to really lead a clear negotiating process now.
Yil Yabi in Dakar.
Africa Link, bringing you the story behind the story.
At least 30 people have been killed in tribal violence in Kenya's coastal Tana Delta region. This is heightening security concerns ahead of next year's presidential election. More than 100 people were shot, hacked, and burned to death in the same region in August and September, where tit-for-tat raids between members of the Pokomo and Oma groups reached their peak. To find out more about the latest clashes, I turned to our correspondent James Shimanyula.
The members of the Pokomo and the Oromo have been at loggerheads for many, many years. I think my count takes me back to more than 50 years. This has been a tradition that they usually quarrel over issues of who has the right to grazing, who has the right to big land for farming. What happened is that at dawn, they woke up, that is the Oromo, only to find the Pokomo swarming into their villages, attacking them. And then since the Oromo were taken by surprise, they had to regroup, they had to make what you call, you know, local shouting to people that were being attacked. It's been a tradition, they know how to call their brothers and sisters just to help them. And then it was fighting free for all on both sides, with the Pokomo having an upper hand against the surprised Oromo. And then it was just the question of each side using lethal weapons. They had the machetes, some had the sticks.
Well, rights groups say that the violence is politically motivated. Is that accurate? And how is the violence linked to the upcoming election?
First of all, you have to bear in mind that each time Kenya comes closer to elections, maybe 2 or 3 months preceding elections, since the 1980s, we have had violence occurring. This violence is believed to be instigated by local politicians colluding with local authorities, in the sense that, for example, like now as we talk, boundaries have been extended in Kenya to the extent that now we shall have more members of parliament in the next legislative assembly than we had. So you find that, for example, the Oromo, a man that was representing, or a woman representing the Oromo and the Pokomo in parliament, was only one. Now they are going to be two. So it depends on who has power on which side of the supporters, like voters. So they create such violence, so we gather over the years, so as to scare the other ethnic group, and then his own people vote for him. So it's loosely tied to politics in that particular sense.
Last time there were political consequences, a parliamentarian was sacked. I remember. Why hasn't that had any effect?
It could not have had any effect because the area we are talking about is the same, but revenge among the two ethnic groups has been on and off over the years. And they don't even look at who was arrested for doing what. It's been boiling for a long, long time. And, you know, we have intelligence there from the government, but it's very difficult to detect because these are people, these are pastoralists, these are farmers. So the way they behave in the rural areas is completely different, that the authorities are taken unaware and things just happen. So the arrest of one member of parliament, whose case is still pending, would not have even helped them not to fight each other.
James Shimanyula in Nairobi.
Human rights.
And Kenya also features in our human rights slot this week. Amnesty International says Kenya's decision to place refugees and asylum seekers in camps away from urban centers is a discriminatory and unlawful restriction on freedom of movement. Earlier this week, Kenya's government ordered tens of thousands of refugees to vacate urban areas and head to designated refugee camps that are already overcrowded. What grounds does Amnesty have to call this order discriminatory? I put that question to Amnesty's country director in Kenya, Justice Nyangaya.
You cannot really have a sweeping statement blaming the wrongs that are going on in the country on a set of people. This is the reason why Amnesty International is saying it is indeed discriminatory, because refugees are now rounded up and taken into camps, even those that were already in urban areas, based on the fact that they are being seen as causing insecurity. And this is not true.
Why do you describe this as unlawful?
It is unlawful because there is freedom of movement. And these people have come into Kenya because of fear of persecution, of fear of losing their lives, and they have run away to seek security within Kenya. The 1951 UN Refugee Convention is clear that Kenya, while protecting refugees, but can also allow refugees the freedom to work, but also freedom of movement. Putting them in the camp is an administrative decision by the Kenya government, so that the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees can provide other social services to them. But those that can provide water, accommodation, and food should actually be allowed to seek to live in urban areas, but even to seek areas of making livelihood. And I think this is not in any way allowed by the Kenya government of refugees to do. This is therefore discrimination and unlawful.
What are your main fears for the people involved?
We particularly feel that the Dadaab refugee camp is completely overcrowded. And having to add this number to an overcrowded situation is placing all these refugees to a real big risk. The fact that they are going to take time to even be registered as refugees in the camp is going to take a long while for them to find food, shelter, and even medicine when they are unwell. We do acknowledge the fact that for many years Kenya has played host to many refugees in this region, but that is no excuse for passing a blanket condemnation of all refugees as potential terrorists.
We have also been hearing in this program fresh violence in Tana River Delta with more than 30 people killed. But this is, it's just one incident. In August and September, there were more than 100 people killed in this same area. Isn't this kind of violence that the government should be concentrating on?
Absolutely, and I agree with you completely. I mean, the government should not be focusing on condemning refugees en masse for creating insecurity. Just last month alone, 30 police officers were shot by cattle rustlers in the Suguta Valley in the north central Kenya. And these were people that were holding small arms and light weapons that were considered to be superior to what the police were using. Kenya government need to look at the laws and the treaty around the arms trade, but also the influx of small arms and light weapons that give people the confidence to take arms against the security system.
I was speaking to Amnesty International's Justice Nyangaya, who is in Nairobi. Many smallholder farmers in Zimbabwe are facing a challenge of practicing cropping system on soils that are low in natural fertility. To get good results in crop production, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, FAO, has started reviving Zimbabwe's agricultural sector to ensure food security. It is adapting agricultural practices that will conserve fragile soils by extending the period of water availability to the crop and improve soil fertility. Columbus Mavunga has been at the country's border with Zambia to visit one of the FAO's conservation agriculture projects.
We are in Urungwe district near the border between Zimbabwe and Zambia at the farm of Kenneth Nyarenda. The 52-year-old has since said goodbye to depending on food handouts, as is the case with other close to 2 million Zimbabweans. He explains to me how his life has changed after he was trained and adopted conservation agriculture, which involves making the most efficient use of arable land over a long period of time.
I was trained last year. I now mulch my crop. Mulching retains moisture.
You can tell that my crop is better than that one across over there. With conservation agriculture, on a small plot, you get more yield than in conventional farming.
He added that he now uses three times more from his piece of land and now has enough maize to feed his family of eight people and sells off the surplus. Nyarenda is one of the 150,000 farmers targeted by the Food and Agriculture Organization to revive collapsed agriculture in Zimbabwe through conservation agriculture. The European Union contributed 9.2 million euros to this project. I asked Felix Njurumi from FAO to explain the reason behind this method of farming, which he calls CA for conservation agriculture.
I think the main reason has been we have seen a drastic drop of the national average in crop yield, especially if you look at maize. Over the past few years, we have been hovering around 0.5, 0.6, 0.7 metric tons per hectare as a national average. When our neighboring countries like Zambia, where CA is doing quite well, they are around 2, 3 tons per hectare.
In this district, farmers have started planting maize again, having abandoned it for some time and instead opted for cash crops like tobacco. They are now able to feed their families with the maize and sell the surplus at the market. Maize, which forms Zimbabwe's staple food known as sadza, is commonly grown in Zimbabwe. But for FAO, it is not only the food security in Zimbabwe which made the UN agents train farmers into conservation agriculture. Felix Njurumi from FAO again.
You use your resources efficiently. As you have seen, you use your fertilizer, your manure, your labor on a small piece of land, and you get high yields on that small piece of land. Secondly, it is environmentally friendly in that you reduce things like soil erosion. You also, it also helps in the conservation of soil nutrients and soil moisture.
For many Zimbabwean farmers, anything that will ensure the country's recovery of the agricultural sector must be good news to them as it reduces food deficit. It puts Zimbabwe's agriculture on the move. And this is what the FAO EU-funded project is doing in Zimbabwe.
Columbus Mavunga.
USA.
Our special thanks to all of you who have been writing in. As you know, our USA lady, Rita Oliver, has left us to go into well and retirement.
I am particularly happy that I could spend my last year at the Deutsche Welle with English for Africa, because for me it was sort of back to the roots. I really enjoyed that year, so a big thank you to the Africa Link team. And I'd like to say a big thank you to all our listeners who have kept me company for so many years. I will miss them very much. Stay healthy and take care.
So while Rita has left us, you say we'll still be here with some new faces from the Africa Link team. And I would like to invite you to keep those letters coming. We do love to hear from you. Before we wind up our program, let's have a quick look at our headlines. Mali's government on Friday held UN Security Council approval for an African-led military force to reconquer the north from Islamist militants. At least 30 people have been killed in tribal violence in Kenya's coastal Tana Delta region. And Amnesty International says Kenya's decision to place refugees and asylum seekers in camps away from urban centers is a discriminatory and unlawful restriction on freedom of movement. And that's how we end this edition of Africa Link for this week. For questions and comments, drop us a line at our postal address, which is Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. Or use our email address, which is feedback.africa@dw.de. It has been a great week, and I pretty much enjoyed being with you as well. And don't miss tuning in over the holidays for our special programs. Till next time, happy holidays from me, Assumpta Latus, and the rest of the team.